trying to survive on just a trickle of aid. Today, November 12th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. 5 days after Typhoon Haiyan, relief teams in the Philippines are still struggling to reach those most in need.
As long as aid doesn't come, the situation is only going to get worse like that. And eventually, what little food there is here is going to run out.
Many Filipinos in the U.S. are worried sick about their relatives in the disaster zone. This nurse in California is heading back to Tacloban to get his mom out.
I'm getting on a plane bound for Manila tonight.
Plus, a history of U.S. involvement in the Philippines. And later, an Iranian rock and roll success story comes to a shocking end.
These kids, they leave Iran with this huge dream, and they were so looking forward to it.
Those stories coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Okay, your cell phone may not always get service when you need it, and that traffic jam you're in, it may get you home 15 minutes later than you planned. But consider what people in the central Philippines are going through at the moment. Hundreds of thousands of Filipinos have no house left to come home to, and forget about phone service or even electricity. 5 days after Typhoon Haiyan wiped out entire communities, survivors are getting desperate. The BBC's John Donison is in the devastated city of Tacloban, where a lack of food and clean water is a major issue now. John spoke earlier with The World's Leo Hornack about conditions in the city.
It is a bleak, bleak situation, to be honest. People woke up today to the one thing they didn't want to see, very heavy rain. There were thunderstorms overnight and there have been downpours all day. And when you've got tens of thousands of people living without a roof over their heads, you can imagine that is pretty desperate. We were in one neighborhood today, I guess a 100-meter square plot of land with hundreds of families had been living there. It had been completely wiped out when the typhoon struck, reduced to just a pile of wreckage, really. And people were there. They'd got their tools out, their saws, their hammers, starting to rebuild their homes. But you looked at it and you just thought, blimey, where do you start? And the thing is, they're asking, when is the help coming? Because you don't feel there is any sense of any major aid operation underway in this city at the moment. And it has now been 5 days since this typhoon struck.
So there's no assistance so far arrived from the outside world?
Well, look, at the city's airport, there are big cargo planes coming in, military cargo planes, Filipino and American. And certainly I was in Manila where these planes were taking off a few days ago, and they were loading up some aid onto these planes, also a lot of military troops and military equipment as well. But where that aid is going and when it's going to be passed out, we don't know, because there is no sign of that happening, and people are getting desperate. We were at a big food warehouse, a commercial business, earlier today, and it was in the process of being completely ransacked. People had stormed inside and they were just grabbing anything they could, big sackfuls of noodles, crisps, biscuits, you name it, and they were like running out of this warehouse and just helping themselves. And as word spread that this was happening, you had this kind of procession of people heading up to this warehouse to get what they could. And I think as long as aid doesn't come, the situation is only going to get worse like that. And eventually, what little food there is here is going to run out.
What do people need most now in terms of assistance?
Food is what people need. That is what everyone is saying. I met one young woman here today, a schoolgirl. Actually, she was in the process of trying to clean up what was left of her house, which was basically nothing. She was kind of scrubbing the mud off what was once her kitchen floor. And she said to me, look, we don't need money. We don't need televisions. We don't need mobile phones. We don't even need a house to live in, she said, but we need food if we're going to survive.
The BBC's John Donison in Tacloban speaking earlier with The World's Leo Hornack. As we heard, some aid supplies are trickling into that city's airport, but it's a different story in other affected communities. Many remain completely cut off from any assistance. That hasn't stopped Kevin Vaca from trying to help. He's an American missionary living in the Philippines, and he's managed to deliver some food to survivors on the devastated northern tip of Cebu Island.
Northern Cebu is deteriorating daily. Today, at the northern end of the island in the town of Maya, which is the eye of the storm pass, the people have not received any food for 4 days, and diarrhea broke out there today. So I'll make another trip up there in the morning to bring more food, but very concerned about the health condition of the people.
As for you, Kevin Vaca, I mean, you're a missionary. You're but one person. But tell us what it was like getting up there with what you had. You had some food for, what, about 200 people, I gather?
Yes. We brought about 500 pounds of rice, and we brought 75 cans of sardines. Now we're going to take another 500 pounds of rice in the morning, and there's no more sardines to buy, so we're taking noodles.
With such a level of destruction, how are people cooking the food? Where are they getting the clean water to cook the rice?
Well, in the last few years, propane, bottled gas here, has gotten very expensive. So a lot of people in the countryside have gone back to cooking with wood or charcoal. So that's not a problem. If they can get rice or fish or sardines or noodles, they can cook it. And they know how to even do the fire when it's raining. So there's quite a bit of ingenuity when it comes to that.
How long can you be making these trips? And when are you going to start seeing more people assisting you?
Yeah, I think the problem is, you know, we're dealing with a safety issue right now. At night, it's impossible because the thousands of people that are lining the roads begging, and of course, nobody has money. There's no teller machines are working. Most of the banks have been destroyed. Those people haven't eaten in 4 days. And so, you know, at some point, desperate people do desperate things.
Kevin, I really appreciate your time speaking with us today. I know you've been totally flat out. Just curious, what are you going to do when you put down the phone?
I'm going to probably just go to bed. I got to get up in the morning early because we got to take this food up to Maya, and we got to get out of there before it gets dark.
Kevin Vaca, an American missionary who's helping with the relief effort on the island of Cebu. We return now to Tacloban, the city that was mostly destroyed by Typhoon Haiyan. The city is Herbert Fabela's hometown. He's a nurse who lives in California, but he was born and went to nursing school in Tacloban. Earl works for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in Fresno, but he's taking a break now.
I'm getting on a plane bound for Manila tonight. A bunch of us, all nurses from the States, we're connecting with the Philippine Red Cross and hoping to get into Tacloban as soon as we can. I'm going because my family, my mom specifically, is there. I've gotten in contact with them, but I want to get them out of Tacloban City. I'm worried about them because food, water is not being sent to them. The house is still standing, although it is in ruins. The roof of the house is not there anymore. I believe it's raining down there again. My neighborhood doesn't look the same anymore. All the roofs of the houses, it's gone. Windows have been blown out. There are trees that have been uprooted. The shops, the stores, it's not there anymore. You don't even recognize some of the streets if you go through them, they said. I'm frustrated with the local government and national government's response because it's very slow. We don't know how many casualties we have in Tacloban. You know, the United States military actually got there before them.
Nursing runs in Fabela's family. His mother worked as a nurse in New Jersey, but 3 years ago, at the age of 67, she decided to go back to live in Tacloban.
Her sisters and her family are there. My cousins are there. She wanted to spend her retirement days with her family. When she goes back there, she feels like it's home. When she's there, you know, all her aches and pains disappear. If you're there, once you get off the plane, the people greet you with a smile. They're friendly enough to make you think that they're family. The mangoes are to die for. The air is fresh. It is a beautiful place to be in.
Fabela knows that his happy memories of Tacloban will be put to the test if and when he gets back home.
I'm getting on this plane tonight to go and see my family and my friends, to see how they are, to know that they're safe. But what I am worried about is when we get there, what we're going to see, what type of devastation that I'm gonna witness over there. I want to see the coffee shops. I want to see, you know, my old school. I want to see the college that I graduated from when I took up nursing over there, and I'm afraid it's no longer going to be there.
VA nurse Herbert Favela from Fresno, California there. He's headed back to his hometown of Tacloban tonight. As Earl mentioned, U.S. military planes were among the first to land at the city's airport after the storm. America's involvement in the relief effort isn't surprising, given our nation's long relationship with the Philippines, which I could use a refresher on. So for today's The World That Was, Chris Wolf, the world's history guy, is with me. And remind us, Chris, how far back the U.S. interests go in the Philippines.
We're looking at the late 19th century, the classic age of great power politics, and a lot of U.S. naval thinkers are trying to figure out ways to project U.S. power into the Pacific and into the Atlantic, both to protect the U.S. coastline from invasion or insult, and to protect U.S. commerce and generally just establish the flag in an age where empires are going around establishing the flag all over the place. Spain at the time occupied the Philippines, and come the Spanish-American War, the American Navy is ready, willing and able to go kick them out and seize the Philippines, but that doesn't go down too well.
I can imagine. Now the U.S. plants a flag. Does this mean that Philippines kind of becomes an early American colony?
To all intents and purposes, yes. But there was kind of like this understanding that the Philippine nationalists who had been fighting the Spanish for independence would get some bigger say. They didn't. And obviously this creates a lot of resentment and actually leads to a pretty prolonged, tough jungle insurgency in the early 1900s against the Philippine nationalists.
So there's this jungle insurgency. When did the United States fully gain control?
In the early 1900s, a little over 100 years ago, but you know, gradually there's accommodation with increasing amounts of local self-government, which helped stabilize the country. But the big turning point was World War II, when the Filipinos and the Americans fought side by side against the Japanese. The Americans got a whole new respect for the Philippine people from that experience. MacArthur was famously kicked out and then returned.
Not too far from the center point of this massive typhoon.
That's right. The famous I Shall Return beach was Leyte, which is not far from Cebu, which has been principally devastated by the typhoon now.
What happened with the Philippines during the Cold War? Did it become a pawn?
Yeah, well, let's just back up slightly. Yes, because of this new respect, the Americans granted the Philippines independence in 1946, but keeping hold of those vital naval and air bases that they'd had since the beginning, which is one of the main reasons that they'd gone in the first place. And those bases provided a huge amount of support for first the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. Millions of Americans passed through Subic Bay and Clark Air Base and other places en route to Southeast Asia, or flew missions out of there in support of the war in Southeast Asia. And in fact, you know, these became small American towns with movies, movie theaters, malls and ballparks, the whole nine yards.
What about now? What's the U.S.-Philippines relationship about right now? And do you find it surprising that the support has been so quick?
Yeah, those bases led to quite a lot of like residual anti-colonial sentiment. And eventually in 1991-92, the Philippine Senate suddenly vetoed a renewal of the bases agreement, and the bases closed very quickly. Things have moved back again since 9/11. The U.S. has been cultivating relationship with the Philippines again by providing assistance against the Muslim insurgency in the south, which has connections to al-Qaeda. And then more recently with the dispute with China over sovereignty of the South China Sea. And so as of last year, the Americans are coming back to, on a semi-permanent basis, to the old naval base at Subic Bay.
Although it has to be said, with millions of people affected by this typhoon, the Navy's going there to help. The U.S. Navy's going to help people in need.
Right. And they can do great things. Their helicopters can help move supplies quickly. They have one of the most critical advantages they can bring is that they can actually make clean water, which, as we've been hearing, has been a critical issue right now, just the access to clean water for the typhoon survivors.
The World's Chris Wolf with today's installment of The World That Was. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Still ahead on the show, a woman turns the tables on her sexual harasser in Cairo. On The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We don't often get to hear what it's like inside a Russian prison, but we can get pretty close by talking to Veronika Dmitrieva. Her partner, Russian journalist Andrei Alekverdov, is in a jail cell in St. Petersburg right now. He was aboard the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise when Russian authorities arrested the entire crew. Dmitrieva says she's heard from Andrei several times since he was detained nearly 2 months ago.
I got a few letters from him when he was in Murmansk, and mostly he was trying to assure me that he's okay, that I shouldn't worry about him too much. You know, I was worried that it's cold in his cell, and he was saying, well, we are getting some fresh air from the window, but in general, it's not so freezing. It's possible to be there. He was saying that probably everyone, even at the detention place, understands how ridiculous the accusations are and how ridiculous the whole situation is, but they cannot do anything.
Veronica, tell me, what are they eating? What were they eating in Murmansk?
Well, they are eating, like in the morning, they are given some sort of porridge. For lunch, they are getting some pasta with some meat, although I've read in another person's letter that he is trying to separate this meat from the pasta so that he can eat pasta without this, what they call is meat. It was quite common thing in Soviet Russia, this meat, because you could buy it in the shop where nothing else was available.
Right.
It's called, in Russian, it's called tushonka, so it's like stewed meat in the can. And for dinner, they get porridge again, it's porridge.
How were Andrei and the other Greenpeace detainees treated in Murmansk by the corrections officers? Decently?
Well, yes, he was telling me that they are treated decently according to the rules. The rules itself are very rude because, you know, for example, during the night, the light never goes off. You have to have a light both during the day and night. It's not possible to switch it off to sleep, and that they have to, you know, wake up at 6 a.m. Well, they can't walk on their own. They're always escorted by the guards, and they have to wear the, what it's called, handicaps?
Handcuffs,
yes. And when they are transported to court or to investigative committee, they are attached by handcuffs. They are attached to the guards. And, you know, Andrei was put in this most, I would say it's the most horrible Russian prison called Kresty in St. Petersburg. It's one of the oldest prisons in Russia.
What do you know about? Why is it so horrific?
Well, it's the oldest and very famous in Russian history for being, you know, a horrible place where people were tortured, where people were dying. It has very, you know, thick walls, very small windows. It's like the prison which, you know, is not a big fun to be in.
Yeah.
It's just so unfair that such a peaceful and such a decent person, you know, I don't know any other person who is so law obedient, who is so kind. He hates violence, and every day for him to be in prison is a crime, and that's why, like, every day for me is a torture. So I don't know how long I have to wait, but I think a week, 2 weeks, a week, even 3 days, it's impossible to tolerate.
Veronica, I'm just curious, in your last letter to Andrei, what can you say to keep him buoyed for this episode?
Well, I almost in my every letter to him, I'm saying that I'm very proud of him and that I think that this case, no matter how horrible it is, it will make him even stronger. That's what I'm saying.
Veronica Dmitrieva speaking with us from Moscow about her partner, Andrei Alekverdov, one of the Greenpeace protesters who've been moved to St. Petersburg prison. Veronica, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, too. Thank you.
Fans of the Iranian rock band, the Yellow Dogs, are still in shock over their horrible news. Two of the band's members were murdered in Brooklyn yesterday, along with a third Iranian musician. The suspect reportedly committed suicide after the killings. It's a grisly story, but today we want to remember the Yellow Dogs' music. So we contacted Farinak Amidi. She followed the band as a producer for the BBC's Persian service, but years before that, she'd met the musicians back in Iran. Back then, Amidi says she was a devotee of the city's lively underground rock scene.
I was taken actually to their makeshift studio on their rooftop of this apartment building in Tehran they were jamming with a few other guys, and we just dropped by, just like all the other kids who did, and you know, just smoked a cigarette and had a drink. That was it.
So, I mean, everybody in the underground rock scene in Iran had some out of the way secret performance space. This was on a rooftop.
Yeah, it was this really shabby makeshift studio, kind of. They tried to make it soundproof. That actually became quite popular in Tehran. On a lot of rooftops, you did find these little makeshift studios where people were just jamming and making good music and having these little gigs. It was really jam-packed, though. It was really hard to breathe.
Now, the Yellow Dogs, would you call them early innovators of the Iran underground rock sound? And what was their sound?
Basically, they had their big break with the Bahman Ghobadi movie, No One Knows About Persian Cats.
Right.
But I wouldn't call them innovators.
How would you describe the sound of Yellow Dogs?
I think when they were in Iran, it was a bit darker. When they left, I think it just reflected their own mood, which was a bit happier. It was kind of like post-punk music. You could totally dance to it and jam with it, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that film No One Knows About Persian Cats, in which Yellow Dogs appeared. I mean, it's poignant, this whole episode in Brooklyn, because the big debate is whether to stay in Tehran and keep the music real or go to the U.S. and become stars. That was the debate in this movie. But in real life, I mean, what kind of things were they saying to you about leaving the country or staying?
In Iran, most of the kids who do music, their ultimate goal is to leave Iran. Because in Iran, what are you going to do? You can't have a gig. You can't have a record out. Any musician's dream is to get their music to the people. And once you can't, then...
And yet the heart of rock and roll is rebellion. Did they ever talk about that or consider that?
I guess in Iran, if you just have an electric guitar and have a bit of shabby long hair, you're a rebel.
Right. You don't have to go too far.
I mean, to be honest, that's it.
What was your reaction when you heard this news?
I was so shocked. I started crying. I couldn't believe it. And I just started chatting online with some friends who knew them in Brooklyn. They apparently were just hanging out. They were having a really, really good time. You know, these kids, they leave Iran with a dream to be able to perform, to be the rock stars that they always wanted to be, because it's impossible in Iran. It's never going to happen. You're never going to be able to become anything in that kind of music in Iran. So they left with this huge dream and they were so looking forward to it. They, on their Facebook page, everywhere, you know, they were excited about even the smallest gigs they had. And they appreciated it so much. And it's just so sad that all of this was taken away from them in a split second.
Farhanak Amidi, a producer with the BBC Persian Service. She knew the members of the Yellow Dogs from their days in Tehran to their new life in Brooklyn. Farhanak, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a reporter turns the tables on the men who harassed her on the streets of Cairo.
I always wondered what the guys who were harassing me, what they were thinking. And I really wanted to hear what they had to say.
Shifting the conversation and searching for empathy, coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We were very, very close, actually, extremely close to getting a deal. That sounds pretty close. And that's how U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry described the three-day marathon talks between world powers and Iran in Geneva last weekend. But in the end, there was no deal. So where does that leave the talks at this point? We have Barbara Slavin, author and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, to help us figure this one out. Barbara, we're seeing a lot of messages and signals from all sides. How close do you think they were in getting to a deal?
I think they were very close. You know, John Kerry himself has said that they came in with a text that had brackets in it, which suggests that they were already very close when they got to Geneva last week. But there are a couple of sticking points, and there's an issue of alliance management that has come up, which is quite fascinating. It almost seems as though the U.S. and Iran were on the same page, but the French were not.
Right. So, I mean, if you look at the spin from the talks in Geneva, a lot of it seems to be about, was it Iran who didn't sign or did France balk at the last minute? Can you unpack that for us? What's that about?
Yeah, it was both, actually. The French decided that they were going to make a big issue of something called the ARAK, that's A-R-A-K, heavy water reactor. This is a project that the Iranians have had that has been going rather slowly. It's not even clear that they can complete it this year, but there are major proliferation concerns. Once it goes online and has radioactive material introduced, you cannot bomb it without spewing radioactive material all over the place. So the French came in and said, well, the Iranians have to promise to stop working on this facility right now. And this was something that the Iranians were not willing to do.
Now, you also mentioned alliance management. There are players in these talks who are not actually at the table but seem to have a lot of influence. I'm thinking of Israel and Saudi Arabia and conservative voices in Iran and the U.S. How much can these people not at the table actually sway these talks?
Well, I actually think that the talks have gone so far that it will be difficult for the Israelis, the Saudis, and others to really change the substance of these talks. The decisions now have to be made by those at the table, namely the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany and the Iranians.
So you've been watching Iran negotiate with the West for a long time, Barbara. The kind of why did this deal fall apart at the last minute, is that kind of important anyway right now? Or do you think it's kind of part and parcel of a relationship where parties have not really spoken in 35 years?
I think we should focus on the positive here. John Kerry said that, I think he said something, he'd spoken something like 30 hours to Iranians, and that was more than we'd spoken to them in 30 years. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. We actually did have direct talks with Iranians after 9/11 that went on for some time, but they were semi-secret, and they were not something that was sort of in the spotlight of the international community or the international press like these were. But there's been real progress. These kinds of contacts now between our Secretary of State and the Iranian Foreign Minister are becoming almost routine. And we had candid shots of Wendy Sherman, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, chatting in the hallway with her Iranian counterpart quite casually. It was really almost, you know, you had to pinch yourself a little bit.
Barbara, what's next with these talks? And are you still optimistic about them?
Yeah, I am still optimistic. There's another round November the 20th. There's time for everyone to go back and try to get agreement on these key issues, the question of right to enrich, the question of the ARAK facility, and come back hopefully with fewer things in brackets, fewer things to finally resolve. I'm sure there are back-channel discussions. The various parties can talk to each other without actually waiting to convene in Geneva. My only concern is really the U.S. Congress right now, because there is yet more sanctions legislation that certain folks in the Senate are trying to attach to some vehicle. They know that sanctions alone probably won't work because the Democratic leadership has listened to the Obama administration and they're not going to allow a standalone bill. If that legislation passes, it will send a very negative signal to the Iranians, and it could require them to act a little tougher, refuse certain concessions just to show that they're not knuckling under to pressure.
Yeah, we'll be watching that. Barbara Slavin, author and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
No agreement yet, which means that for now, we can assume Iran will continue to enrich uranium, and the U.S. won't change its economic sanctions. Those sanctions are aimed at Iran's government. They also make it really hard for ordinary citizens to do business with the outside world. For one thing, the sanctions don't allow major credit card companies to process Iranian transactions. One family-owned business, though, has come up with a workaround. It started accepting the virtual currency, bitcoins.
واحد پول بیت کوین هم از طریق یکی از اقواممون جا آشنا شدیم با استرالیا.
That's Morteza Rokani. He and his brothers run a 70-year-old leather business in Isfahan that sells handmade shoes and handbags. He says a cousin of his in Australia suggested the Bitcoin idea and helped them get started. It's only been a few weeks, but Rokani says the company's international business is already picking up. Rokani says the brothers have gotten orders from Finland, the U.S., and Hong Kong. Now, those bitcoins still have to be exchanged for hard currency, so Rokani's leather business can purchase supplies. That means dealing with, again, banks. So for Iranians, the system is not foolproof. But Rokani says he and his family have to try. Rokani says just getting the leather and glue they need to work has been challenging and expensive. He's hopeful things will get better soon. And he says he's encouraged by Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, and the promise of more nuclear talks. Maybe, just maybe, he says, the business that he took over from his father 15 years ago will make it through these tough times. I was a little surprised by this, but maybe shouldn't have been. According to a new survey, Egypt is the worst place for women's rights in the Arab world. This came out of a poll of gender experts surveyed this summer in 22 Arab countries. And one of the reasons they ranked Egypt at the bottom is sexual harassment. It's a constant problem for women there, Egyptian women and foreign women. Reporter Julia Simon lived in Cairo for 2 years, and she says she got harassed every day, every single day. But one day she got to the end of her rope, and she decided to stop and ask one of those harassers for an interview on tape. Julia told me she just wanted to hear what he had to say.
I always wondered what the guys who were harassing me, what they were thinking. And in the media, there's been a lot of reports on the women who get harassed and their perspective. But the men's perspective, I found that lacking, and I really wanted to hear what they had to say.
All right, so let's not beat around the bush here. Let's hear a piece of the conversation. This is in English, but your conversation was in Arabic, correct?
Right. We recorded the conversation in Arabic, and then I got a friend to do the English version with me. So I started off by asking the guy to tell me on tape what he had said to me on the street. And here's what he said.
I said, you're like sugar.
Anta fakir, okay?
Do you think it's okay to talk to a woman and say she's like sugar?
I mean, yeah, it's fine.
Have you ever put your hands on a woman? I mean, in Tahrir, some guys do that. Do you know what I mean?
The man. Yeah, I do.
So you have? A lot of times?
Not really, you know, just sometimes.
So what do the women do? Are they mad?
You know, there are ones that get upset and the ones that don't. You know, it's not every girl.
I gotta tell you, when I'm having a bad day or there's a guy on the street, a guy like you, and he says to me, you're like sugar, or goes, tss, 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 you know, it really makes me upset. It makes me sad. I mean, it makes me feel, no, seriously, it makes me feel like you're treating me like I'm not a human being, like I'm a water bottle or a tree or just some inanimate object.
I mean, I'm sorry. Don't get upset. I'm sorry. It was just an expression, and I didn't mean any harm. You know, there are apparently people who do this a different way, you know, not the way I did it. You know, and there are girls who I'd say something like that and become, you know, friends right away.
How long have you been doing verbal harassment like this?
Look, there are nice ways. It's just like flirting. There's, you know, you're just flirting. You get it.
If a guy did this to your sister, though, like, what would you do?
What would I do? I mean, if it was my sister, she wouldn't really say anything back, at least. I'm sure she wouldn't reply. I mean, for me, it's just a simple expression. I mean, when I see a beautiful girl and I just say it, it's normal. It's not impolite. You know, it's just normal.
It's normal? This is not normal, I have to tell you. In Europe, there is not sexual harassment like this. In America, it's not like this. You know, Egypt is famous for this.
Only Egypt.
Really, in the Arab world, Egypt is famous for its sexual harassment, for its streets not being safe for women. So what do you think of this?
All this because I flirted with you? I mean, we're not famous for this. There's politeness. I just, you know, I just like to do this. I like to say you're like sugar, but I won't do it.
Wow. So that was just a part of the conversation translated, and you kind of reenacted it with a friend of yours in English. You say you're really upset. He says it's just flirting. Were you worried at all about how he'd react?
Well, I mean, I probably wouldn't have approached a guy who said something very vulgar or more aggressive. I think when I did this interview, I just figured that, and I was right, that he would just be some kind of normal guy who just happens to sexually harass women because it's so normal. As he said, it's normal in Egypt. That's how they think of it.
He said you were like sugar. I mean, some people hearing this might think, okay, so what's the big deal? He just told a woman that he liked the way she looked. She looked like sugar.
Well, I mean, I have gotten harassed in America from time to time. The thing is, in Egypt, it's incessant. It's every single day, every single street I walk down. And that's why it has such a big impact. I mean, he could say you're like sugar. He could say something a lot more vulgar, but it's the fact that it's all the time. And so it makes walking down the street, you feel stressed out all the time. You feel like you can't relax.
And it's not just you and other foreign women. It's kind of all women, right?
Yeah, it's every woman. I mean, basically, if you have two X chromosomes, you're going to get sexually harassed. And you could be any age. You could have blonde hair. You could have dark hair. You could have a hijab. I mean, it really doesn't matter. Any woman will get sexually harassed. And as I talk to my female friends about this, we've built up a kind of armor around ourselves. So when we walk on the streets, we're constantly on guard.
So you conducted your own little experiment. Is anybody kind of doing research into this in Egypt on men who harass women?
Well, I was really happy to find Professor Hani Henry. He's a professor at the American University in Cairo. And it turns out that he recently began his own study. So he's been interviewing men, and he told me that some of them have told him that they are sexually harassing women because they want to make the street a place where women don't want to be. They want to push women back into the home. Another thing he said, a lot of the men said to him that it was just flirtation and that women actually like it. They don't see it as aggressive or violating the women's space. They're not able to empathize with the women. And yeah, that's a big thing. As Henry says, that if you want to do intervention or prevention with these young men, you're going to have to teach them empathy.
So, Julia, with that guy that you stopped in the street and asked a few questions of, did you get any sense of empathy from him?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I tried to get him to imagine what it would be like to be me, to be a woman. And first I tried saying, imagine you are a woman and you're walking down the street and you feel this every day. How would you feel? And because of the social stigma of imagining you're a woman, it actually, I think he thought that I was asking him, imagine you're gay. It was such a big social stigma that he couldn't even imagine this. So that approach didn't work so well. However, when I asked him to try to imagine what it would feel like if you were treated like you were an inanimate object, like you were a tree or a water bottle, which were two of the things that I could see, two props on hand, I kind of got this feeling that he could sort of feel how hard it was for me. And he definitely wasn't getting everything I was saying, but I did leave the conversation feeling better than I've ever felt when it comes to talking about sexual harassment.
That was reporter Julia Simon talking about interviewing a guy who harassed her on the street in Cairo, something that happens to women there all the time. It's an unusual and, gotta say, pretty gutsy experiment. If you have questions for Julia about her experiences in Cairo, let her know. She's on our website right now taking your questions until 9 p.m. East Coast time. Just go to PRI.org to join the conversation. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember the Coneheads? Well, time for a sideways glance where we find a story that makes us do a double take. And this Conehead glance goes to a statue of the Duke of Wellington in Glasgow, Scotland. It can often be seen with an orange traffic cone on its head. Lawmakers in Glasgow had enough, though. They announced a plan to raise the statue to make it harder for pranksters to put a cone up there. That didn't sit well with Gavin Doig and Donna Yates. They were at the foot of the statue earlier when I chatted with them. Let's start with you, Gavin. How is the Duke of Wellington today? Cone or no cone?
The Duke of Wellington is sadly coneless today. I think the council must have been round at the weekend and deconed them in advance of the publicity.
And I gather you are surrounded by some cone protesters. Are they pro-cone or anti-cone?
Oh, all pro-cone, yeah. A number of the protesters do have cones on their heads to make up for Wellington's sad lack.
Right. Are you wearing a cone yourself?
Not just at the moment, no. I couldn't find a cone in time, unfortunately.
And just tell me, when did this tradition of placing an orange cone on the Duke's head begin?
It's something like 30 years ago now. So, I mean, the statue's had a cone on its head for about as long as I've been alive. You know, it's a well-established Glasgow tradition.
Gavin, can you pass me to your pro-cone colleague, Donna Yates, for a moment, please?
I certainly can. Here she is.
Hello there.
Hi, Donna Yates. I gather that you and Gavin Doig, with whom we just spoke, actually started a petition to save the Duke's cone.
We did indeed. It went extremely well. We closed it today when the council took down their planning application with about 10,600 signatures, so pretty good in under 24 hours.
Does that mean that you've succeeded, or are there still some questions?
There are indeed some questions. The council hasn't said that they're not going to raise the plinth. They've just taken down this application. We feel personally that raising the plinth is more dangerous than anything else because a high plinth will not stop a drunk Glaswegian and more people will just fall trying to access the statue if it's any higher.
Donna, you don't sound anything like Gavin does. Where are you from?
I lived in Boston for many years. I'm in Glasgow because I'm an academic. I study the protection of heritage at the University of Glasgow.
You study the protection of heritage?
Yeah.
So this seems like a pretty fitting little moment for you to be studying. What are you drawing from it?
I'm quite interested in the solidarity. How many people have come together over the cone? Just looking out over the crowd at the cone party, it's people of all ages, all races. Everybody can rally around modern cultural traditions like this.
And Glaswegians, I gather, aren't the only ones rallying around the cone. Your petition got people writing in to you from all over the globe.
Quite a few people from Wellington, New Zealand, which is interesting because this is a statue of Wellington. We got people from Belgium, where Wellington fought the Battle of Waterloo. So a lot of interesting places.
Donna, have you or Gavin ever put the cone on Wellington's head? Be truthful now.
I have not put the cone on Wellington's head, but who among us have not ended up with a cone on their head once or twice?
Donna Yates, along with Gavin Doig, they started a successful petition to keep the tradition of sticking a orange safety cone on the head of the statue of the Duke of Wellington in Glasgow. Donna, thank you, and thank Gavin on behalf of myself.
I will.
It's funny. One of America's enemies is the Taliban, such an innocent name. It means students in Arabic. Singular would be Talib, as in the American rapper Talib Kweli. And that's who we're going to talk about right now. Kweli is Swahili for true. Well, the true student has been called the deepest thinker in the rap game, and the name shows just how big his thinking is. The World's Andrea Crossan met Talib Kweli when he was in Boston last week.
Like Jay-Z rapping about his drug dealing days and Rick Ross about his days as a prison guard, Talib Kweli raps about his life. He grew up middle class in Park Slope, Brooklyn, the son of academics. His work has been called socially aware and politically insightful, and far-ranging. On the song Push Through, he raps a line about the Arab Spring. Fighting for freedom like the people in Tunisia, spread through Sudan and Egypt. This the music for the movement. The score to your achievements. Never join them, so you gotta beat them. It's Carpe Diem, hey. Hey. Yeah.
When I'm in the studio, I'm making music for me. These are things that are on my mind. And I don't worry about whether or not people understand it until I'm on stage saying it for them. It's not so much about me trying to teach you about the Arab Spring, but it's about if you feel the same way as I do, then you can relate to me. Bothered by vigilantes that harbor on street corners.
Try your hardest to harvest bundles of weed on you. Talib Kweli's latest album is called Prisoner of Conscience. The title comes from what Kweli sees as people's perceptions of him.
Well, being considered a conscious rapper is positive. It's a huge, huge compliment. And it's something that I take seriously. But any artist doesn't want to be put in a box. So it goes against my artistic sensibilities.
Kweli doesn't want to be thought of as just a conscious rapper. But it's in his DNA to write about issues and not assets. The track It Only Gets Better includes shout-outs to an Azerbaijani activist, an Iranian human rights lawyer, and to members of the Russian feminist punk band Pussy Riot, who are now in prison.
I don't know Pussy Riot, but as an artist, I really relate to them. The lawyer, and I don't remember the name, I know I said it on the record, but that's something I had to look up. And I even had to look up how to say it, so I said it right on the record. I knew about Pussy Riot. I knew about the popular Prisoners of Conscience, but I wanted to represent some of the ones that weren't as popular, so that's something I had to look up. Prisoner of Conscience, man. Whenever life bring me down, I think about those freedom fighters. Those who put their life on the line. Those who get jailed for their thoughts. Like Tural and Bosky. Put in jail for organizing a protest. On Facebook. Like Mumia Abu-Jamal. What up, Mumia? Prisoner of Conscience, man. Free Pussy Riot.
Kweli writes about what moves him. But he doesn't throw shade on more commercially successful gangster rappers or their legions of fans.
They may be taking away the wrong message from it, some of these newer fans. They may be just taking the attitude and the aggressiveness and the swagger, but they're relating to those artists because of those the pain inside that music. Objetividade na vontade de crescer.
I don't want a banger to be the hit it or stab it. Listening to voodoo, I call it the black magic. Talib Kweli is currently touring the U.S. with his Prisoner of Conscience album. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan in Boston. Onomatopoeia got me flowing when you rock on my boat. Like you, Aaliyah, got them African features like people out in Bahia. Mix it back with the reefer like you was a European. When I leave, I'm going to miss you official like harder now. Trust to come back and I'll visit for kind of foul. When I come back around, take me out on the town. And you can show me how you put it down. My favela love, man, I fell in love. 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 Man, I, yeah, yeah.
That's Talib Kweli and Brazil's Seu Jorge on the track Favela Love. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.